Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hello, I'm stand-up comedian James Mullinger and the co-founder of Edit Magazine. This is Mullinger Meets Canadians, the podcast where we meet Canadians who are making waves on the world stage. In this week's episode, I'll be speaking to comedian Jason John Whitehead. Born in Cole Harbour, Nova Scotia, he studied at Dalhousie University in Halifax before moving to the United Kingdom, where he swiftly became one of the top comedians, performing award-winning, critically acclaimed shows annually at the Edinburgh Festival, appearing on numerous television shows, and playing all of the best clubs. His new album, Live Before Lockdown, was released last month and immediately hit the number one spot on iTunes. Since 2016, Jason has been living in Los Angeles, where he was one of the head writers on the Jim Jefferies show. I last saw him perform live in 2018 with Jim Jefferies at the Imperial Theatre in St. John, New Brunswick, and it was one of the funniest, rowdiest, most memorable shows I've ever seen, and you'll be hearing all about that shortly. I was fascinated to learn from him what it was like working with Jim Jefferies on one of America's biggest shows on Comedy Central, the differences between British, American, and Canadian audiences, and meeting Maritimers in Hollywood. Jay, welcome to the show. Thank you for being here.
Hello, man. Hey, thanks for having me. Good to see you.
It is great to see you too. We have crossed paths and countries over the years.
It's the Canadian Maritime one in one out rule, right? So now that I've traveled around, I came to your country. Now you have to live in mine. So I hope you're enjoying New Brunswick.
Very much so. What year did you leave Canada and move to England?
In 98. I left.
98, right.
Yeah, 98 I left. I graduated from Dalhousie University in Nova Scotia and went off to do the I gotta go find myself thing, you know, which a lot of Canadians do. So
yeah.
Yeah, man.
And you're performing stand-up in Canada, obviously, before you moved to England?
I wasn't. I went to Dalhousie, right? So I said I studied the health professions and I actually worked in South Carolina for a while. I was an activities coordinator. Used my health degree to be an activities coordinator at Marriott Hotels. So I was in Hilton Head Island in South Carolina. I was doing like dolphin trips for them and golf tournaments. Basically, you know, you organize the activities for people who come to stay on Hilton Head Island. And I just got kind of bored, maybe of the rules. You know, you had to be clean cut. You had to wear it. I was the only guy on a dolphin tour in a boat, you know, feeding fish to dolphins and talking to tourists who had to have a tie on. And I remember, you know, and I had to be clean shaven because I was Marriott. And meanwhile, all the other reckless dolphin tours are out there, you know, and they look shaggy. They look basically like the way I look now or the way I have looked for most of my career, which I longed to feel that freedom. So I came back to Nova Scotia briefly and told my parents I had to just get out and go see the Commonwealth, I guess, because we get a free pass. When you're Canadian, you get 2 years to go to, you know, they give you a stamp in your passport and you can go work and live in any Commonwealth country. So Australia, New Zealand, and I moved to Scotland in 98.
Amazing. And yeah. Did you have thoughts when you got to, was it Edinburgh specifically that you were in and living in?
Edinburgh was the first place I moved to. So yeah, specifically. And I always wanted to be a comedian, basically, but I was naive. I was a naive Canadian, I guess. The only route to being a comedian that I saw was to go to Toronto. So in all honesty, I was intending to go to Toronto to do my master's. I was going to do journalism for my master's. And it was kind of an excuse to, I was going to try to become a comedian at night. You know, that was my game plan. Because it's not a career that you, well, I mean, some comedians do, but I guess I don't. And several other comedians, it's hard to admit it out loud to people. Before, yeah. Especially before you've even done it or anything. It's not. Like, until I started becoming a comedian, I think there was less than five people in my life who I had told, you know, in privacy or in moments of vulnerability, you know, just leaning over. And I remember I worked at a hockey rink briefly, I think when I was close to ending my degree, and I had a buddy who I worked with at the hockey rink, and I remember leaning over to him at one point and going, you know what, I'm going to become a comedian, you know, and sharing that. But it's not something I would share with closer friends and or even my parents and family. So
especially 20 years ago, 20 years ago, I mean, there was, I mean, now hardly anyone's making any money from it. But then it was definitely not thought of as in any way a sensible career.
There was no comedy club in Halifax either, you know. And so, yeah, so to me, it was a thing that happened that the only chance was Toronto, you know, if you don't have a way to get to America. And in Scotland, when I moved to Scotland, I got to admit, I didn't know that I was going to walk into a comedy culture, which is stupid and naive, you know. But having not grown up in Britain, it didn't even dawn on me. Of course, the Eddie Izzards and the Billy Connollys have given birth to a whole, you know, community and a whole genre of comedy. So stumbling into that when I first came to Edinburgh, I was staying in a hostel. And on the second night, a bunch of us from the hostel, we all went, let's go check out comedy. And we went to a comedy club, and that was it. That was it for me. I changed my mind about, because I was intending to do the whole European trip, right? I was going to 2 months in Scotland, 2 months in Amsterdam, 2 months, you know, in Portugal, and just like backpack around, spend my time learning and finding myself. And and then return to Canada and get back on track and maybe move to Toronto. But it turns out I went to that comedy club my second night backpacking, and it was only like 2 months later, I think I called my friends and my family to say, hey, I'm not going to do this bounce around Europe thing. I think I'm going to just spend the whole 2 years here in Edinburgh and become a stand-up comedian and maybe occasionally pop over to parts of Europe for a weekend break or something. But other than that, I'm good to go. So that's how that came together.
Amazing. And then, of course, so that was, so 98, and then it was 2000, obviously, that you won the BBC Best New Comedian. So obviously,
that really iced me staying, really.
Yeah.
Because that was, because I lost in 99. I was brand new, brand spanking new. So I probably started comedy in 99, I would say. So even though I moved there in 98, I got a job at this place, the Balmoral Hotel, which is on Princess Street Gardens. There's a restaurant there called Hadrian's Restaurant, which you also had to be clean cut for. That was also a 5-star restaurant. But that really pays the bills. If you're a foreigner, when you're a foreigner and you move to Britain, especially if you're Canadian or an Australian, getting a bar job or getting a restaurant job is I'm not going to say easy, but I'm going to say it's our bread and butter. Because Canadians and Aussies and Kiwis and stuff, we kind of show up with an optimism and a joy for, oh, so this is history. This is fun. And they tend to put us behind bars or, you know, serving in restaurants. Because I think British people, they have a little more of a hang-up about the service industry, don't you? You got a little bit of a class system rebellion in you. Like, I work in a 5-star restaurant and bring rich people their food? I ain't doing that. So that was my initial...
It's just a miserable outlook. It's a miserable British outlook where we're just miserable about doing everything.
Yeah. Oh, you want me to pour you a pint, do you? Yeah, I do, man. It's your job. You're behind the bar. Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, now I got to pour... Yeah, it's in your job description. So that's really how that started. So that got me there and had me the job. And then, just getting stuck in, going to that club all the time. Because the Stand Comedy Club is great. They really nurture new talent. A lot of new material nights and stuff like that. So that was it. That iced it for me.
Amazing. And then so you were there. You were obviously in England till 2014. So during that time in England, you obviously toured and performed in other parts of the world. What were the kind of big differences that you felt between like the British comedy club scene and the scene in Canada and, of course, now America as well?
Well, I mean, the big difference, because I was new, most of my stand-up comedy culture is British because I was so spanking new, and this is how I learn comedy, and like I said, there's no breaks in North American comedy, and that's one of the biggest striking differences, other than the styles of comedians. You know, they're more anecdotal in Britain. They do more longer style of comedy. But overall, I think the culture in the audiences is different because a British comedy audience, They treat it like theater, really. They have two breaks, you know, to go to the bar and get their drinks and also to discuss the comedy that they've seen. And I think that breeds a very different comedy culture at the clubs. Because then you come to North America. I think I did my first North American gigs maybe 2.5-3 years into my career coming over. And that's when I first saw the attitude of like, no, we do a 90-minute show. We go straight through like a movie. And I think therein lies the difference. I think North American audiences are groomed to feel a stand-up comedy club experience is like a movie. And British audiences are groomed to feel a stand-up comedy night is like theater, and you get shit-faced in the breaks.
Yeah, that's it. Because that's the real reason that there's all those intermissions. It's because in a Canadian, it's funny in Canadian and American clubs, this kind of two drink minimum thing. Whereas in England, they have a 20 drink maximum.
Yeah, exactly.
It's such a kind of different thing where, you know, here you could not expect a British audience to go more than 30 minutes without getting a round of drinks in.
Yeah. It's always, after a 20-minute mark, you can see the look on their faces of like, all right, mate, you're fine, but we still like beer more than you.
Yeah. And can you imagine if British clubs attempted table service?
I know, it would be ridiculous. And I'm wondering if they ever did, if there ever was a point where they thought, maybe this works. And then they went back to, you know what, just let them go get their own drinks at the bar. I mean, I think it works great, you know. And the atmosphere, I got to say, the atmosphere in a club, when you just have one long bar at the back and you just tell audiences, get your beers, you know, this next section is going to be 25-30 minutes. And then the bars will be open. But having that bar shut during a show brings the focus to the stage. And it's, you know, that for me is such a great British thing. Whereas there's sayings in North American comedy like the check drop and things like that, which defines what they do, because they have waitresses walking through the crowd, like, you know, not to sound too snobby about it, but they're drawing the attention of the audience as a waitress swans through and you know, and sometimes it's a little loud. They're like, what do you want to drink? Right. When you're trying to hit a punchline. It's a little bit, it's more difficult to tackle. And the check drop, of course, which means it's like usually when the headlining comic is trying to power home the show, he's in the last 10 minutes and, you know, waitresses just want to drop those checks. So that it's the attitude of we got to get everybody to pay up, because when the comic does his last joke and is off stage, it's done. You're getting out. You're gone. Whereas Britain doesn't do that. In Britain, they kind of go, all right, you've had a great night. When the comic wraps up, you know, it's almost like, but we've locked the doors until you pay your bill. So go back to the bar, go to the back bar, get one last drink for yourself. You know, we'll still hang out for a bit. So, you know, give us some more money for a little while and then pay your bills yourself or we're not going to let you leave. You know, very different attitude.
It's so true. I mean, and also, I mean, would you say, one of the things that people often talk about is that, you know, British audiences are known for being less forgiving, should we say. Like, did you find that it was the kind of, a lot of people say that it's the best place to kind of learn the craft, because you don't have much grace at the start of your set. You've got to get them very quickly.
Yeah, definitely. British audiences have their backs up right away. And especially some of the notorious British clubs, you know, like Up the Creek. Because Up the Creek, which of course notoriously, so Malcolm Hardy famously hosted Up the Creek all those years. It's in Greenwich, which is like South London. I think it was Sunday night shows, right? And where they'd have new acts and stuff. And he would literally introduce the acts to a rowdy audience too, the South London ravenous audience. And he would introduce them by going, here's the next act. Could be good, could be shit. Let's see. And he would nurture the heckling. And so if you didn't have your backup or something quick to say off the top, yeah, you were toast, you know. And then you contrast that with the style over here, which is they just want to give all these credits. They want to go, okay, before I come up to the audience, can you tell them that I've been on, was on Letterman once? I just, you know, I just did Fallon and I'm in a Subway commercial or whatever they need. Yeah. And then that doesn't work with a British audience. That they'll be heckling right away.
Yeah, well, it's funny because in England, like, whenever, if you're emceeing, the first thing that the headliner will say is, don't say they're going to love me. Don't give them any credits. Just bring me up. Because as soon as you say they've done this great thing, the British audience is going, wanker.
Entirely. There was one time at the comedies, we were in the Comedy Store Oh, I actually do remember who the American comic is, but I'll save his name for the sake of this story. But we were at the Comedy Store, and it was all British-based act, but this guy was in town doing a guest spot. He's not a famous American comedian, but I think Paul Thorne was hosting. I remember Paul went around to each of us and said, what do you want to come on to? And we all listed music. You know, I was like, oh, can you bring me on to My Michelle, Guns N' Roses, you know, or Ben Norris is there saying, you know, can you bring me on to some mod track, you know, by the Mod Father and whatever. We all listed that. And then Thorne looked at the American comic, what do you want to come on to? And he literally said just that. Can you tell him that I wrote for Leno Once Upon a Time and I've got this podcast out. And, you know, and last year I guested on a talk show hosted by Keanu Reeves. And like Thorne, he was just looking at him and going, nah, mate, you'll get a song. That's it. That's what we come on to here. And it didn't work. He actually went out and tried to introduce himself that way. So to the British audience, because, and he was kind of bitter about it. He was kind of like, that guy, I told that guy to tell you what I was. And there, you could just see and then he tried to list them himself. You could just see the British audience go, oh mate, we've made up our minds about you. Yeah, you're toast.
We already hate you.
yeah. And then he just struggled. So that's an important lesson to learn, that bragging doesn't get you anywhere in British comedy.
No, they just want you to do the job and you've got to win them over quickly. And that's the key. And I mean, I think...
Well, that's it too. They love you if you're a little, like, think of yourself as a little bit shit. That's the British audience, isn't it? Or even the British attitude. Like, if you can come up and say that you're as shit as they feel, you're going to give them a great Friday night. Because they just start laughing right away, going, ah, we're shit too. It's that attitude. Whereas I got to admit, sometimes it goes over an American audience's head. Sometimes if you're hard on yourself, sometimes that's the way they see it. If you're just being self-deprecating sometimes to open it up, sometimes an American audience will look at you and go, this guy's really hard on himself. And it's hard to backpedal. It's hard to go, no, I'm being facetious, we're doing a comedy thing here, and
yeah. I'm just pretending. I know I'm amazing, really.
Let me just dig this hole even deeper.
And then do you find a big gulf of difference between the Canadian audiences and American audiences when you, because I know you obviously perform primarily in America, but when you come back to Canada and do shows, and is there also differences across Canada?
Well, I think so. There's differences. Every night in every venue, right? Like you can't, there's nobody who goes, I'm going to British Columbia and all the clubs are the same. Because if you go to tour British Columbia, you're going to see, you'll have a different scenario from night to, you know, it's all governed by the attitude of the people in there. You know, regular comedy clubs who have more experienced comedy goers and stuff like that. So it's not a huge difference, but I mean, I think I can get a bigger difference out of a Canadian audience because I unload on a Canadian audience when I'm up there being Canadian. So in a way, I think there's a little extra joy that comes out of me of like, you know, it's great to be home and what's going on. And, you know, I know a lot about every Canadian city, of course, because I've moved a lot when I was a kid because my father's military. So to that point, I think there's something different in the attitude and stuff. And especially if you go to Canadian cities that don't get to see much stand-up comedy, they're happy right away. So they're ready for a great night out. You know, and I don't know, the way I get to know American audiences is usually to purposely put myself on the back foot when I get up there. I usually make fun of them at the start and get them a little bit angry. Get them like, just make fun of, you know, their football team, their basketball team, something. And I get myself on a little back foot, you know, and usually try to get myself out of it, you know, within that first minute, which is often quite fun. You know, I think I think it was in Atlanta. And Atlanta was a rowdy audience, but I just started making fun of their hockey team, the Thrashers, and just sticking the knife in, just going, you guys can't even support a sport. They moved to Winnipeg and they're having a better time. This is a group of people who lived in Atlanta. And after a couple of years here, because you named them the Thrashers, you know, they decided, oh, this is, we're the smallest bird here. We got the Atlanta Hawks, the Atlanta Falcons. And then, just, you know, just getting them angry. And then slowly they ended up having fun with it, you know, after a while. They kind of warm up to you after you recover, you know.
Yeah, but that's the skill of what you do. And that's one of those things that comes with, you know, decades in the business. not, you know, it's not something that anyone can just walk up and do. That's something that you've done, obviously, by touring and,
and by risking it a few times and failing. that's the way we learn all of those things. Like, oh, yeah. Oh, the times has gone wrong.
And have you been in LA now since 2014? Is that right?
I like to say that I have officially been here since 2016 because I actually still had my place in Britain, I think, until 2015. I was kind of going back and forth. So my first trips over were in 2014. Because I had a couple buddies are here, like Rhys Darby, who was working with Flight of the Conchords, and Jim Jefferies was over touring like crazy. Oh, he had a sitcom at the time as well. So I was kind of coming over and staying with them, coming back and forth and weighing up my options and slowly deconstructing my life back in Britain. 15 years is a lot of, it was a big decision, really, even though, you know, I might have a North American accent and everything. It was a big decision to move from Britain. So I did it kind of gradually. And now here I am and it feels like 100%.
Right. And it's home. Yeah, it's funny. My wife was in London for the exact same amount of time. She left New Brunswick in 1999 and left in 2014 to come home, so to speak. But of course, as you say, like, that's such a huge part of your life. It's all your kind of adult life.
I knew more about Britain than I did about any other country. I mean, I know a lot about Canada just being Canadian and of course just catching up on your Canadiana whenever you can. But the reality of just living in Britain and getting to know the road in Britain, like every weekend I'm in a different British city if I'm not working like somewhere else in Europe or something. But you get to know all of Britain, which really arms you for when you're talking to British people, you know, who challenge you, like who think that you know nothing. And then here you're just talking about restaurants or, you know, landmarks in certain towns or, you know, a suspension bridge in Bristol or, you know, you're able to list all these things and British people are like, holy shit, you know my country. And I'm like, yeah, I lived there for 15 years, solid.
Yeah. And you know more of it than most British people because, as you say, you've been in every single town, city,
It blows your mind when you meet a British person or, say, an English person who hasn't been to Scotland. You know, when you run into those, which happens in Canada, because I'm sure you're running into Maritimers who have never been past Ontario. You might even be running into Maritimers who haven't, you know, because when they go on holiday, maybe they go to Boston or they go to Barbados or the Dominican Republic or something. And, you know, because it's a big country. But being in Britain, being such a small country, I never thought I'd hear that out of British people. But yeah, I've talked to a lot of English people who are like, oh, what's Scotland like? You know, way up there. And I'm like, what, you mean like 4 hours? 4 hours drive. I mean, at most 8 hours if you're all the way down south. But it's like driving, it's like being from Halifax and driving up to Cape Breton, you know? But
But I've had people in St. John say to me, what's Halifax like? I mean, people that have been here their whole lives, it's like, really, you've never taken the 3.5 hour drive to check out Halifax?
Yeah, or a short break. Like, no, man, if we're saving our money for a trip, we're going to Hawaii.
Do you ever meet Maritimers in Los Angeles at all?
Yeah, there's a couple of us. Actually, it's quite hilarious. Okay, I'll tell you. Well, so Tracy McDonald is here. So she's a fantastic stand-up comedian. She like won Star Search. She won Star Search like the same year that I won the BBC, I believe, in Britain. So the two of us, both Maritimers, we both won the two biggest competitions in each comedy market. And so that was an interest. I mean, not a lot of people realize that. Tracy and I are very aware. Because of course my winning the BBC catapulted my career in Britain, but her winning Star Search catapulted her career in America. And then we would see each other back in Halifax. Like if we came to play, like when the local comedy clubs started sprouting up and stand-up comedy became more viable night out. And that's how we got to know each other. And then we used to always laugh. Like we were like, wow, we two Maritimers took the biggest two pops in the international industry in the same year. But what I was going to tell you was that there's one very cool thing about meeting a Maritimer in LA, because there's not many, but there are some of us who get out, you know, I actually, so I subletted. I subletted a place here in LA when I was first moving over for one of those periods where I thought I'd come over for a month and a half, get the lay of land, and I was subletting a place just down off of Hollywood Boulevard. And I was subletting from a singer who I had met, an American singer. She was on tour in Japan. And so I had told her that I was going to go to LA for a bit, and she offered me her place. She said, you can sublet my place. She didn't tell me that it came with a roommate, which is fine. But I did show up at her place, and then this guy was there, and he was like, what are you doing? Like, I think he thought I was breaking in, because I don't think she told him.
She didn't even tell him.
Yeah, I don't think she really broke it down to him, so he had to figure it out. And then we had this moment in the hallway after we'd been living together for like a day. And he said to me, he goes, so where are you from? And I was like, oh, I'm from Canada. And he goes, oh, me too. And I was like, oh, cool, whereabouts? And then he goes, oh, from Nova Scotia. And I was like, no way, me too. And then he said, where are you from? And I said, well, Halifax. He goes, holy shit. And so we actually completely bonded. So here we were. We're just thrown together as roommates in Los Angeles. And we're still good friends now. So he's a music producer. From Nova Scotia. So his name's Darren. He's Darren Baby D Beats Smith. I think he does a lot of K-pop and stuff. Great guy. But that was our first meeting. And we had that moment of just looking at each other going, are you lying to me? And trying to figure it out. And then it turns out we were both telling the truth and we couldn't believe it. And whether or not you'll believe it, that has happened twice to me. The second time was more realistic. Yeah, the second time was more realistic because we were playing the Ace Theater here in Los Angeles, gorgeous old theater in central Los Angeles, and the Kids in the Hall had been playing as well. The Kids in the Hall were on, I think, the two nights before us. So we had these Kids in the Hall, so we had this big influx of Canadiana, as I like to say, of all these people catching up on Kids in the Hall. And then on our opening night, we were on like the rooftop having a closing party or something, like celebrating the night, and some of the Kids in the Hall people were there, and I ended up talking to this guy, and it turns out we went to the same high school in British Columbia. So I went to high school in BC for 3 years because I'm a military kid, and we had the same teachers and everything. So we had, he's actually the producer on my album that I just released. Because he works as a producer for Kids in the Hall and stuff, but because of the quarantine, he was able to work with me and get this album out. But we had that moment like 4 years ago because we doubted each other. You know, he's like, "Well, what? Really? You lived in Vancouver Island?" I was like, "Yeah." What, on high school? I went to Reynolds High School. He's like, "No way, me too." And that just happened. We've been best friends ever since. So, I mean, it's pretty great. It's pretty great when you do run into a Maritimer. It's like, you know, it's an even better version than when you run into a Canadian and you're backpacking around the world and you got that little Canadian patch or whatever, which always allows us to go, oh, an ally in logic and you know, de-escalation and kindness. So we found him. So, I mean, that's always a great moment, but it's even better when you're on like a rooftop bar in Los Angeles trying to celebrate, you know, a great comedy night. And then there it is, a fellow Canadian.
Yeah. Yeah, it's beautiful. I mean, and it's a uniquely Canadian thing. I mean, I feel that now. And now, just being here 6 years, I find that when I go anywhere else and I bump into a Maritimer, it's an immediate hug. It's an immediate, like, feeling of connection. Because, I mean, there aren't many of us here. So the odds are. And invariably, whenever you meet a Maritimer anywhere else in the world, it is one of the only parts in the world where if they say, do you know Dave on whatever avenue, chances are you will. Right? It's not a stupid question.
It's very possible. Oh yeah, that was definitely the case, especially in the dating pool back in the, like, when I was going to Dalhousie and like living in Halifax. Yeah, I remember that very well. You're it's less than 6 degrees of separation. So you never know. Somebody will know somebody. When you're telling a story of a girl you met last night, they'll be like, oh yeah, oh what? Oh, Diane, oh I know Diane. They're like, oh god. So that happens all the time.
That's true.
Yeah.
And so your album Live Before Lockdown, which is an amazing name, even without lockdown. I was thinking about this. I was thinking, because it sounds like a Metallica album anyway.
Oh, right.
even if there wasn't a lockdown. But of course, you obviously recorded it before lockdown, but then it was edited and released during lockdown. What challenges did that present, or did it actually mean that you had kind of more time to focus on it?
Yeah, like I was saying, the guy who produced it for me was working with Kids in the Hall. They're supposed to be on tour right now as well. So in a way, that was lucky timing for me, because I was able to capitalize Robin's time. Because leading up to that, because I was supposed to be recording the album like last week, I was supposed to tour Asia. I was going to be in Kuala Lumpur and Manila, do this Asian tour, and I had been building all this material, and I thought, this is going to be great. I'll do 3 nights in Kuala Lumpur, and I'll record an album over the 3 nights, and it'll be cool. Now, that all went out the window with, you know, the situations of this year. And so what I did have was I had about 100 hours of recording from when I was trying to practice the material and learn all the material and, like, get things right for the last year and a half of touring, because I've been recording everything, and there's some great recordings. So in a way, the quarantine gave us the time, but the style of album we did, we needed the time, because I basically handed my producer 100 hours of stand-up, and I gave him the instructions of, like, I want the best sounding gigs, but you can choose the best gags. You can choose the most refined jokes and routines, as long as they're great sound quality. And then off he went. So I'm sure it drove him nuts, but that would have been all of April for him, you know, just going through shows, because he was calling me and he's like, I'm going through the Atlanta shows now. I'm going through Tampa. Tomorrow I'll get to Calgary and Edmonton, and then I'll check them all out, you know, kind of thing. And so that took a whole month before he came back to me with, like, these are the best bits. And then carved them down.
Yeah, I mean, it's beautifully done, and I love that. I mean, it's funny, because you've always prided yourself on being a comedian whose focus was always to make people laugh. That's what you do, as many laughs as possible.
That's the goal.
What I found amazing, what I found amazing about this album is that, I guess what I mean is you've never kind of, you know, tried to necessarily brand something with a theme. Whereas what I love about this is there is a lot of ground covered. There is a lot of political statements in there. In a funny way. But I mean, I love the stuff, for example, on the point that you make is, you know, we're liberally minded people, but there are scary liberals out there that are now scaring us more than right wing nut jobs.
I really enjoyed doing that routine. And one great thing is there's a development of that routine since that recording. So that would be Boston. There's a Boston segment, which I believe is maybe the third track to the sixth track on the album or something. It's like, it's the album starts in Calgary, and then we move to Boston. And Boston, of course, being America, is the only venue where I did more American politics-y kind of stuff. Every other stop, Rotterdam and like Sweden and Sydney, it's all more social comedy, social commentary, something that's more universal. But yeah, I let loose on Boston a bit, because I knew this is a place to unload more a political opinion. And I love that routine, because that routine actually grew since Boston, and it's not on the album the way it's grown. So in a way, it's given me a launching pad, I think, for when we get out of quarantine. I think I've got my first, like, my new direction going for the next set. So it's fun.
And I loved the segue in between the change in cities, because it's interesting, because you're listening to it and you don't need to know what city you're in. In some cases, it becomes apparent. In some, it becomes apparent when you are in Australia. But I love the I love the plane sound between.
Oh, thanks, man. Yeah, we played with some ideas. Yeah, because as you might guess, it started with an idea of, like, maybe I should introduce each city and go, like, here, you know. And then we realized, no, actually, it's more fun if it's, because you can tell, you know, like you're saying, like, some cities, it's obvious. Like when I'm talking to a London audience, and of course, in Boston, I literally say I moved here to America. So you can tell. I mean, and I think when I'm talking to Sweden, you can hear me say, you know, Swedish people or European. That's right. I do a routine about European women in Sweden.
All true.
So we played with that a lot. So we were toying with, because I love some old albums. Like, I remember Bill Hicks had the Flying Saucer tour, and Like, so sometimes you've heard these old comedy albums and they haven't been shy to go, here's an adventure here, here's a piece here.
But Richard Pryor's were often cut up like that, weren't they?
Right,
like Pryor might have one set from one city. And again, you don't need to know. And it's like you were saying earlier about the fact that, you know, the universality of comedy and the fact that, you know, one club, even though there are changes, ultimately it's about the people in the room on that night, and really it's universal. You're not doing it, but there was something magical about kind of figuring it out while you were listening. And it's I thought
I was really happy when we arrived at the plane decision. Just a simple plane noise to let you know that we are changing venues, we are changing countries, but you can go ahead and try to figure out exactly where. Yeah man
Yeah.
That was a funny one too, because that was one where Robin, my producer, that was when we finally came up with the planes. I think he was exhausted already, because like I said, he's already gone through hundreds of hours of comedy, and then we've whittled it down. I think we whittled it down to like 38 tracks or whatever in the end, and I think in the end on the album there's 19, and so all the patience for that, and then when we came to the decision to do the airplane bridges. Between changing venues, he had already tried so much stuff. I know he was exhausted, and then he had to redo the airplanes, and then just to be the asshole artist, I ended up coming back to him and going, "Hey man, can you turn the airplanes down? They were too loud," and I could feel his eyes roll like through the phone, like, "Oh God, now you want the airplanes turned down?" I was like, "Yeah, dude, I just find that it's too jarring and loud." So we actually had to have that conversation at one point.
Amazing. But this is the reality of the intricacies of recording an album, and of course the intricacies of comedy itself. I mean, one of the things that I loved that was kept in there was, of course, the you know, there's so much kind of very tightly honed material that you perfected, and then there's that magical moment when there's like a 12-year-old in the club, which again, just a brilliant producing decision and creative decision to keep that in, because I mean, none of that, some banter with audience members, we can all use lines that we might have used before, but with that, that's all pure and in the moment.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, I mean, we went back and forth about that one as well, but it's really fun to leave that in the album, and I think it helps that the whole name of the track literally is Man Brings 12-Year-Old Son to Show. So that just lets people know, oh, this is going to be an improvised in-the-moment kind of routine. I think it helps to know what's going on, because I know what's going on, but when I listen to a track, I'm like, is an audience going to understand that I'm just talking to somebody in the front row here, or will they think that I'm on stage delivering this like a routine? And I think it's clear. I think people get it.
It definitely works beautifully. And of course, when it was released, I mean, we were talking about the positives and the negatives of doing stuff in lockdown. And of course, I mean, the one thing that people were desperate for when this kind of global pandemic hit was obviously reasons to laugh. And of course, I mean, the album shot straight to the top of the iTunes charts in America, Canada. Like, how did that fare?
Yeah. Oh, it was fantastic. I mean, that's what you want. I mean, it's hard. I mean, it's a difficult thing to pull off, but luckily, you know, you can get out there and do a pre-sale of your album now and get some interest going and get eyes on it and stuff. And so that was, yeah, it's hugely beneficial, especially since I'm independently produced this time around. I mean, my last album, which I love, is with Stand Up Records in America. It was my first album on an American label, which was exciting. But it charted at about 16. We got it to 16. I think I took the lessons I learned from that and from being with a label on my last album, and I kind of took them and applied them to being independent this time. I mean, I got to be honest, if I'd have hustled as much on this independent album, if I'd have done that kind of hustle with addition to what the label was doing on the last album, it probably would have got to number one as well. But I didn't. But those are things that you learn in the end. You learn, oh yeah, even though I'm in bed with an entity here that's going to push me, it doesn't hurt to be out there pushing yourself as well, and you know, doing your part to boost it even more.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, that's definitely something I've learned coming here, where, you know, there isn't obviously, you know, there's not really a star system in Canada, full stop, but in the Maritimes, there's not an existing industry. So it is that thing where it's all about the personal hustle. But I mean, I know when I first saw the album artwork, I wrote to you to say how much I loved the album cover, and you pointed out another setback with doing an album in quarantine. Tell us about how the artwork came about.
I mean, that's another happy coincidence that worked out really well. And I actually got a guy to design the cover who's also a Maritimer. So. I contacted my buddy Ted LaPierre, who actually did an album cover poster for me probably about 10, 12 years ago. And so I contacted him in Nova Scotia. I was like, dude, I got to make a cover here, but I can't book a camera. I can't book a photographer or anything because this was like crisis time. We weren't allowed even out, you know? And I was like, I don't want to get do a selfie in my room or anything like that. So I actually gave my buddy Ted in Nova Scotia access to my photos, you know, and had the whole thing of like, well, I just don't know. None of it feels like the theme of what we're trying to achieve here. I don't want to live before lockdown and then for me to be, you know, standing in a studio or something. But he went through my photos and he came back with my passport picture. And I remember at first I was like, you want to use my passport picture? And he was like, well, it just seems to work for me. And then I started thinking about it. I was like, actually, it makes sense. We're doing an album about flying to different venues and everything. Like, my passport is like this photo that's on the cover of the album. Now it's kind of dressed up because it's got clouds around it and planes and stuff. But the reason why I look so grumpy or like look so stoically faced is because it's my actual passport picture. And because a lot of people have asked, why aren't you smiling right there? I'm like, dude, it happened. We did an album called Live Before Lockdown about me flying to all these different venues, and there it is. It's my in the end, we used a passport picture because you can't get a photographer in quarantine. And I think it's a happy circumstance. I think in the long run, nobody will even ask. So, like, oh yeah, that makes sense. Perfect for the theme.
Well, you're also lucky because, again, I just saw it and thought that's a great portrait, right? I wasn't even thinking that. And what's funny is, like, you must be the only person in world history to have a passport photo in which you don't look like a dick. That's a really impressive
thing. Well, see, I got to be honest with you, though, man. I think the planes and I think the other graphics that he's added to it help. I think that helped because if you saw that passport photo, like, in my passport... Like right there, you'd be just like everybody else, be like, oh yeah, you look like a dick. Yeah, it looks like you're gonna rob somebody or something. But I think purple clouds and stuff really helps bring out. I mean, for any of you who have grumpy people in your lives, you know, just put them in front of a green screen and add some clouds and maybe an angel halo, and you'll be good to go. Cheers everybody up.
So true. How many years now have you been working with Jim? Like, I know you obviously worked together in England doing clubs and then tours, but in terms of the Jim Jefferies show, how long have you been working on that together?
Well, we did three seasons. So we're in our, we did three seasons. We're currently off the grid. You know, I hate to say, I'll never say we're canceled. I'll just say that we're not renewed. We're currently not renewed. So until some miracle TV network comes up and goes, hey, we need more of these. It's a show that, it was really good. We really enjoyed it. But three solid seasons. But yes, I go way back working with Jim. So of course, we did work together on the British circuit a lot. We even were paired together, like in the really early days of our careers, we were trying to become a double act. I want to say for Zoo Magazine, but do you remember Zoo Magazine and Nuts Magazine?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, yeah.
And they had like this competition to have comedians have an online presence for them and do like a column every week. And Jim and I, we were the finalists for that. The guys who won it went on to do a show called Little Chef, Big Chef. Remember those boys? But we were in the final two. So it was me and Jim versus quite clean-cut English guy. So it was a brash Aussie and a Canadian. And I remember our final clip, we were actually standing on a London bus, like a real London, like an actual in-service London bus. It was driving through London, like Finsbury Park-ish. And we stood up on the top of the bus and slapped each other with fish just to shock the... That was our final... I remember that. Like, there we were, new comedians. We're like 24, 25 years old. We were doing Homer Simpson, just yelling, shocking the bus. you know, the spontaneous audience yelling, na 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 na, fishing, and then hitting each other in the head with fish. And I, you know, who knows why Zoo didn't give us the job? You know, who will ever know why they went for the more predictable comedians?
What did it feel like to go from, because, you know, you guys, you did all the clubs across the UK together, came up together. What was it like when you kind of sat together in the writer's room for the first time, knowing that you were doing this kind of huge show that wasn't just going to be kind of, you know, viewed by, you know, millions in America, but also globally? Like, how did that feel to you both?
Oh, super exciting. I know Jim was over the moon. Yeah, I mean, it's perfect, isn't it? Like, I was so excited. It was the easiest, I gotta admit, like I said, I went to Dal and everything. I was always in trouble for being late. I was late a lot in my youth, you know, late for things. I had never learned maybe to just give people a little more respect and show up on time. Like, to me now, that's one of the most important things. But I think having a job that I loved, that I couldn't wait to be at, was a big thing too. So when I first got the job, I think I lost about 10 pounds because I was stressed out. So I was having trouble sleeping. I was like, am I going to be able to crush this? Can I write some political jokes? Can I do this? I'm mostly just a social comedy guy. So it was stressful at first, but then, you know, 2 weeks into the job, if you get that first couple shows under your belt, and man, I'm at work an hour early. I was just loving it. You know, I was never late, and, you know, it's what you want. It's what you build for, right? It's like you're in there writing jokes that are going to go on TV to an international audience. So it's
the dream. I mean, did you find that process made it more, like, did you become kind of more productive in your own writing? Because that's a huge discipline to kind of be coming up with that kind of level of comedy every single week.
Oh, yeah, it definitely helps. 100%. There's stuff that gets put on the cutting room floor that sometimes you're like, if you know that it's like that, it's not so Jim Jefferies that this can definitely be used in another show. So I had files for that. So sometimes if something missed out on a show, but I knew it would be great in Jim's voice, then I would always file those away and then put them in another script. But some other ideas I was able to run with. In fact, the Boston set that you mentioned on my album, like a couple of those things, I can't remember what the joke was that you mentioned off the top, but there's in that same routine in front of the Boston audience, I do something about scientists being liars. I have this routine
and I love that. The Stephen Hawking thing, and they're pranksters, right?
Yeah, so this whole idea that Stephen Hawking is a prankster, and like, yeah, when everybody, you know, he gets everybody to look up at the galaxy, and he didn't really have ALS. So when everybody turns around and looks up at the galaxy, he gets up from his wheelchair and runs around and then sits down before you're looking. Now, that was in our show. And that was a really like a visual gag. So I had written a bunch of these, and they were a visual gag so that Jim could deliver the line. But the funny thing would probably be the image over the, like the over the shoulder shot, with it being like a mock news style show. So that over the shoulder shot showed up, and it was Stephen Hawking like sprinting out of his. So it was a still mock up from our graphics department. And I really felt, oh, like, what a great joke. It's a great joke. And there's the image of Hawking running, boom. And I remember thinking it would never work as stand-up because it needs that image of Hawking standing there. And the week that we were airing, I think the morning of, there was a crisis. It might have been, I'm not sure, but it might have been the Las Vegas shooting or something. Something like of world news happened, and we ended up having to rejig the whole show at the last minute and doing rewrites, and so massive cuts to the piece that we were working on, which I don't know, it somehow got to scientists being liars. So it was probably about some climate change denial. It was probably
that's what it is in the album, right? It's about the absurdity of climate change, climate change deniers, and how they basically just hate facts and think all scientists are lying.
Yeah, so you'd imagine how at first I was bummed that it got cut from the show, but I think I went on stage like the next night, and I don't know. I thought, okay, well, can this work without the photo, without an over the shoulder. A goofy graphic of Stephen Hawking. And then it did. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And then it grew from there for me. Like, and then it grew beyond. Then I ended up having some examples of that. And so then it became my stand-up. So that's one of those happy coincidences that happens when you're committed to writing a show. So sometimes the fodder becomes useful, you know?
Yeah, that's beautiful. I remember last time I saw you was you were here in St. John. You and Jim Jefferies were playing the Imperial Theatre here in St. John. There was two shows, and I believe members of the audience were throwing up in both shows. People talk about it still here. It's like, you know, I was there that night, right, when the guy got thrown out and was. Yeah, and it was an amazing night, and I saw both your sets. I didn't see all of Jim's second one, but both your sets were different. And I love the story that you told about partying with Axl Rose the Welcome to the Jungle line. It was just magical. One of the things that I thought was really beautifully done was how. During your set, you found a kind of a funny way of basically conveying to the audience, like you might think that Jim is your buddy, but it isn't fun for you to shout out. Like don't think that you're in the show. Shut up. And of course, inevitably,
this must have been a hell of a. This is, you know, because gigs, of course, do start to blur into one. But this must. But the fact that you can remember this moment, I'm like, right. This sounds like we were dealing with some hardcore disruption.
Yeah. I think it was just like it was almost like you sensed it. So you preempted it. Like you could sense it coming, and then you gave them their warning. And it was seamless and it was funny. And he went straight back to material. And then Jim came out and he started the Cosby bit. And someone said something. And he made everyone in the room stand up and made them all. He said, everyone point at that person and everyone say one word. And everyone said the C word. And again, which is not top of mind in Canada. Like in England, people just call each other that anyway.
Yeah, but many things in England. It can be a compliment. In England.
It's definitely a friendly term. If this wasn't a Canadian podcast, we would have said it called each other it 50 times already. And what was fascinating was just seeing that kind of way of handling things. Like, did you guys find that on the road? Because you were kind of known as kind of rock and roll comedians and people would see your work and know that you were the kind of fun guys. Was there that kind of element of crowd control with some audiences, did you find?
Yeah, I think you need... Yeah, sometimes you need little tricks, like especially like in Liverpool and stuff. I think it's a lesson that you learn in stand-up. You know, because every now and then you'll see a newer comic, if their show gets disrupted or something, they immediately turn on the person, like, how could you? You're interrupting me. You know, I'm trying to do something here. And that never helps. It never puts... anybody at ease, and yet it happens frequently because sometimes people are just so, I don't know, they're so stuck in their performance mode that they feel a derailment is a complete offense to them. How can you? And so I think you do have to learn that with certain audience, that kind of attitude doesn't help. You know, especially I think about Liverpool all the time because in Liverpool, yeah, if you bark at a bunch of Geordies or something that, you know, like, shut up, I'm trying to finish my joke here. That's not gonna get anywhere. Whereas if you learn to instead go, oh, yeah, sure, let's just walk all over my jokes. You know, I came here to give you guys the jokes, but what, you guys want to chat about something else? You know, just if you change your attitude, it can help you get back on track. Easier. Kill them with kindness, I think, is the way to go, you know, especially with the rowdier audiences.
That is such good advice that would work for any job. I guess my final question, anyone can use that advice. So my final question is, what are you looking forward to most about after the lockdown, getting back on stage? What's the thing that you can't wait to do?
Oh, wow. Well, So I know this is only audio, but of course I can see your buddy, but I've written about 10 pages of material. So I had the one joke, like I said, which expanded my whole, the left and right political joke from Boston. So what made it onto the album is of course going to be gone. But like I said, it evolved into, there's a couple other metaphors and stuff. So that was my new jumping off point for all my new material. And then, So then I did a little FaceTime Live and stuff last night, and then I've just found all of a sudden I'm generating material. Now this is, of course, is cocky, but for any comedian who's in lockdown, which is all of us, I'm sure we're all writing material, and we're like, oh, I've got an hour of material, but it always takes that first performance to realize your 1 hour of material is actually only 3 minutes, you know, but I am very much looking forward to that. So I've got sheets of material, like I'm ready to go with new ideas and stuff like that. So I'm ready to see the confusion, the occasional confusion in an audience's eyes, and then the occasional joy. So that's one of the best bits. And I got to say, since we've been in lockdown so long, this is probably going to be the first time for a lot of comedians where they're hitting a stage going, you know, like before 2020, when I'd hit the stage, I had one or two new ideas that I was going to try to wedge into the middle of my set, and hopefully they'll grow. And now I think comedians are going to be, they're going to be chomping at the bit when we get out of here, and they're going to go, I got 20 new ideas. So I got 20. I'm going to go for it. And let's see what sticks. So that should be a fun period.
Oh, well, I can't wait to see what's in store. I can't wait for your next album, literally live after lockdown.
Yeah, yeah. Everything's going to change, isn't it? All of society's going to change. So, you know, I think every stand-up comedian has probably evolved in their, or devolved in their house. Yes. And so it'll be fun to find out which direction we've all gone in.
JJ, I cannot thank you enough for your time. And thank you for your services to comedy and services to the Maritimes globally, my friend.
Yeah, well, and thank you for entertaining the Maritimers, man. Thank you for coming and making a home of my beautiful part of the world. So we're very proud to have you, man. And, you know, same thing. We all know each other. So
yeah, exactly. We do. Well done, we do. Man. Virtual hugs, my friend.
Yeah.
And I will see you in America or in the Maritimes very soon, I hope.
Yeah, certainly, man. Hope to see you soon.
Thank you for listening to Mullinger Meets Canadians. If you like greatness, creativity, being inspired, laughing, or just love Canada as much as I do, then this is the podcast for you. So please do subscribe and review the show now. And be sure to buy Jason's album, Live Before Lockdown, on iTunes now. Further details can be found in the brand new volume of Edit magazine, available from all good book and magazine retailers across Canada, or from our website, maritimeedit.com. See you next time.
Podstarter.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.